Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Karen Godrowski with us as well, professor of political science and director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center at Iowa State University. Karen, good to have you on board as well.
Karen, and thank you.
Yes, maybe I didn't say Karen. Karen, if I misspoke, please excuse me. Karen Kodrowski. Let's reach out to our listeners as well. You can join our conversation as we survey about a half dozen political topics in our news, 1-866-780-9100. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking about how Republicans across the country are trying to block curriculums that emphasize systemic racism. And we'll talk about Iowa's new law taking effect tomorrow, how that fits into the national picture and to the political picture. And we'll be sharing some poll results from a new Iowa poll on that, asking Iowans whether they favor or oppose that new law. You can join our conversation with your view, 1-866-780-9100. That coming up in just a few moments. Also, seeking the unanswered questions about the January 6th riot to come later in the hours. And speeding up visas for Afghans imperiled for aiding the United States. But first, let's dive into infrastructure. This has been a theme going on for several weeks now. Yesterday, President Biden arguing in Wisconsin that the bipartisan infrastructure proposal agreed to last week would benefit working and middle-class families around the country. Here he is in La Crosse, Wisconsin this week, talking about the American Jobs Plan, going over some key tenets, building out physical infrastructure and hiring Americans to do it.
Here's what it's going to do. This deal will put American workers to work in good-paying jobs, not minimum wage jobs, not $15 an hour jobs, prevailing wage jobs, good-paying jobs. Repairing our roads and our bridges. You all know why that matters. 1 in 5 miles of highway and roads in America are in poor condition. 1 in 5 miles. Some states it's worse where the weather is tougher. 50 years, 50% of our bridges are over 50 years old. More than 1,000 bridges here in Wisconsin are rated as structurally deficient by engineers. 1,000, just in Wisconsin. And that doesn't make Wisconsin better or worse. It's all across the nation. It's this way. There are bridges, the 10 most traveled bridges in America, need repair, and some need to be completely rebuilt. It's more than just an inconvenience, it's about safety as well. But this is a drain on our economy as well. Typical American, and varies slightly from state to state, but the typical American pays a hidden tax of more than $1,000 a year in wasted time and fuel due to traffic congestion. Now, and the more rural the areas, the less the congestion, but it creates other difficulties. You all know that feeling, losing time, sitting in traffic or being rerouted because the bridge isn't wide enough or the road is poorly maintained. This deal is going to put Americans back to fixing all of that.
President Biden yesterday in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It was his first time pitching the bipartisan infrastructure proposal to the American people since he nearly derailed the deal in an off-the-cuff remark last week. He spoke to reporters at the White House. He said he wouldn't sign the bill. He had just negotiated unless another sweeping proposal of Democratic priorities landed on his desk as well. Well, there was some quick work evidently by the White House behind the scenes. That's been smoothed over. Dennis, let me go to you first of all. Do you see this bipartisan deal holding, gaining enough traction to, have enough support in the Senate, for instance?
I think something in some form will come out of all this. If there's anything that members of Congress and politicians generally love to do, it's to spend money in their own state or district, when we teach students about the way Congress operates, we say that normally the three main functions of a member of Congress are lawmaking, representation, and then one of the key things is the old phrase, bringing home the bacon. So every member of Congress loves to say that I brought X amount of federal dollars to this state or to this district. The difficulty, of course, is that for a member of Congress, anything spent in my state or district is absolutely necessary. We need to do it. But most things spent in your state or district, that's illegitimate spending. That's waste and fraud and abuse. But members of Congress love to spend money. And the problem so far with regard to infrastructure is basically the question, what counts as infrastructure? Mm-hmm. So that's what we're seeing at issue now, is spending on Project X, infrastructure, but spending on Project Y, not infrastructure. That's what's being debated right now.
Right. And Karen, before your response, let me share from our two senators their comments, at least a couple of their comments. A sticking point, evidently, for U.S. Senator Grassley is the funding for electric vehicles and not enough emphasis on expanding ethanol requirements. Of course, he'll be a key vote if this bill is to pass, as will the possible support of U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. She takes issue, evidently, with child care being included in the bill, saying it strays too much from true infrastructure, in her words. Your read on the support that this bill has and may have in the future, Karen?
Well, I think there will be some bipartisan consensus about repairing roads and bridges and probably broadband. And in terms of Senator Grassley's, critique about not having enough for biofuels or electric vehicles, that's where you're going to see the horse trading come in, right? Mm-hmm. Where a lot of members are weighing in on what they would like to see tweaked or changed because it either serves their constituency or they believe it's good policy. And that's going to be happening. But I would reiterate Professor Goldberg's point that part of what's going on here is an attempt to redefine infrastructure, right? Is infrastructure, roads and bridges and tangible items, sewer systems and water and things like that,
yeah.
Big construction projects, or is it other things that are necessary in order to ensure economic growth?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're thinking about economic growth, then certain things like, broadband clearly make sense. It also implies that child care and elder care and Medicaid expansion would then make sense as well if it takes away other barriers to full employment.
Right. And we have to think of, should someone vote against this because of child care, that would make campaign fodder, wouldn't it, Karen?
You
would think. Maybe not.
Yeah. Right. But or they might have to make the choice to say, well, because it does these things in my district, I'm going to support it. But I can go back to my constituents and say I voted for, the bridge repair and the road expansion. I opposed including child care.
Right.
But where that's really going to be crucial is in the Senate in terms of what pieces end up in the bill in order to get the bill through without a filibuster.
I would add that this is an attempt by President Biden, I think, not just to meet a need, but to shift the nature of our politics. I've often said that, the German theorist of war, von Clausewitz, famously said that war is the continuation of politics by other means. But what we've had over the last 30 years in America is that politics has become the continuation of war by other means. And in that situation, particularly under the impact of cable TV, talk radio, and the Internet, compromise has become a dirty word. And people would rather have nothing than to compromise on something. And what President Biden is attempting to do, whatever one thinks of the wisdom of that or not, or whether it's feasible, is to return us to an age in which compromise is possible. We'll see how far that goes now. You would think if anything could be compromisable, it's infrastructure spending, but that's what we're looking at the moment.
A couple of other comments from our congressional delegation to share. The sole Democrat in Washington from Iowa, Cindy Axne of the 3rd District, she's pulling for the whole package, as are all Democrats in the House, including broadband expansion, child care modernization. Randy Feenstra in the 4th District here in Iowa, he called the bill a Trojan horse for the far left's agenda on Twitter this month. In Sheldon, he said he agrees an infrastructure bill is needed, but not to the level that is being proposed. He said if we're going to do infrastructure, it has to be infrastructure. It has to be something that there is there for 20 to 25 years. It can't be for research or for one-time dollars that isn't part of infrastructure. We'll see how this develops. Any final comments, Karen, before we move on to our next topic on infrastructure?
Well, I would just say that the Republicans aren't wrong in terms of the Democratic strategy here. The Democrats, see the fact that they control the House, the Senate, and the White House as giving them a moment to legislate and a moment to move, public policy in a direction where they've been hoping to move it for, quite some time, right? And so, I think they are trying to take advantage of this and to see what they can get through while they have control of government, realizing that it could be a very short window of just 2 years.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, our two political scientists on board this hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Well, this month, Governor Reynolds signed a bill prohibiting public schools, universities, and government agencies from teaching so-called divisive concepts. And these concepts include the idea that the United States of America and the state of Iowa are fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist. Let's listen to a couple of our state lawmakers. Here's State Representative Sandy Salmon, a Republican from Janesville, speaking on why she thinks Iowans support the bill, followed by State Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad on why he feels the bill is hypocritical.
Iowans don't believe that America or the state of Iowa are fundamentally racist or sexist.
But we can't have it both ways. We can't say on one hand we want freedom of speech, on another hand and say we want to hear both sides, then stifle those sides.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, start us off. Remind us what this is all about. And we hear this phrase, critical race theory, thrown around now as a slogan, remembering that a lot of people who are saying it probably don't know what it is, or entirely what it is, I guess I should say. It's become a really polarized issue. What do you see going on here? Dennis Goldford, are you there? Karen, let me ask you then.
We'll get Dennis. We'll get Dennis. Yeah, we'll get, I know, we'll get I'm Dennis sure you back. Will. Yeah. well, this needless to say, is a topic of discussion here at Iowa State around me and my colleagues. The more that I see these, and of course, I was not alone in having passed legislation along these lines. As many as a dozen states were considering it, and several have in fact passed it and enacted it into law. One of the things that I think here is that this has just become another way for Americans to, to talk about race and to condemn what they see as, the excesses of the left is what Republicans are referring to. I think critical race theory has become the intellectual equivalent of a straw man or a straw person. Most of what I hear it characterized at is not critical race theory. And while I'm sure that there are some academics or trainers somewhere in the world who might say the things that are banned in the law, they are not being true to what critical race theory is, or allowing the United States to move you know, past its history. And if you, you know, we need to understand our history so that we don't repeat it. And that's, you know, it's going to be a difficult needle to thread for some folks who do, you know, who do the kind of work that we do at colleges and universities to comply with the law, which is a state agency we are obligated to do, while still being true to the principles of academic freedom and critical thinking, and to, you know, teach our students, you know, about some of the less pleasant parts of our history.
Mm-hmm. This law to take effect tomorrow, July 1st. If you've just joined us, the new law targeting diversity trainings and classroom curriculums that examine how racism continues to influence American society. This law in Iowa banning the teaching of several concepts during mandatory diversity and inclusion trainings offered to state or local government employees, many other aspects, as Karen just elucidated there. Let's go to some listener input. Douglas is with us. Douglas, I see you're from Iowa City on my screen. Welcome to the program. What's your take on this?
Well, it strikes me that the big thing that sits behind this debate, but people don't talk about that much, is why do we teach history? One reason you teach history is so you can learn where you came from and avoid making the same mistakes again. But another reason that people have for teaching history is to instill a sense of patriotism in the next generation. If what you want to do is instill a sense of patriotism, then you avoid teaching anything divisive. You teach people the party line about what we are and what we believe. And I think this debate is at heart about the purpose of teaching history.
What do you think about that, Karen?
Well, I think that there's, I think there's something to that, but I would say that you don't want to set up a false dichotomy between the truth and patriotism, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that actually one of the most patriotic things that one could do would be to understand one's history so that you can improve your country.
Striving.
Yeah,
striving for an ever more perfect union.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, if you're taught that everything has always been great, then you're not getting an honest vision of history, but you're also then not equipped to be able to think about what kind of improvements need to be made. And, you know, part of the legislation calls for, like, teaching alternative perspectives. And as one of my colleagues mentioned in a discussion that I heard today, it was like, so what's the alternative perspective on slavery?
Yeah.
And that's a darn good question, right?
Well, I think I have the at least one answer to that. I mean, I grew up in a time, maybe you did as well, Karen, when slavery as a cause of the Civil War was de-emphasized and states' rights were emphasized. It was slavery was part of it, but certainly not the degree that we understand it as under the, for instance, Project 1619.
Right. Or I've even seen, you know, perspectives where interpretations of historic sites have been referred to, instead of enslaved persons, have referred to as servants, right? Which then really gets around the, you know, the horrific human rights violation that slavery is.
Okay. Karen, we're with you solo. Dennis Goldford, just an update. He wrote to us, speaking of infrastructure, my power just went out. Dennis, we hope you'll be back a little bit later. I don't know what's happening there. Dennis, let's see if you can get your power back on and be on with us a little bit later. Let's talk with Chris. Chris is with us from Des Moines as we talk about this new law going into effect tomorrow, banning the teaching of concepts that are deemed divisive. Chris, we're coming up on a break, but what do you have to say?
That in itself, it just doesn't make any sense what they passed this, because what you're trying to do, you're trying to change the real history, like you just said, dealing with slavery. It existed, it went on, it happened, and to try to say, well, it didn't happen, or to try to look at it in a whole different way, and then to try to act like systemic racism is not a problem, but it is, because we still have racism, discrimination that still goes on today. It's even worse today than what it's getting worse because of the laws and the bigotry of the House and the Senate, not only here in Iowa, but throughout the country and also at the federal level. And until people start speaking about the bigotry that is going on, instead of being quiet about the bigotry, that's why we still have racism, discrimination that still goes on today, is because we're not calling folks out on what they are doing.
Right. Chris, do you feel this new law going into effect tomorrow will somehow affect you or your family personally?
Oh, yes. Oh, most definitely. Oh, most definitely. Iowa didn't put a target on people's colors back now. And so things are, if you look here in Des Moines, how the city council is doing, trying to silence voices, even at the, with the Republican Party, it's doing more of a disservice than a service to people of color. People of color here in Iowa, you have some that are leaving this state because of what's going on. Because it's going to make things worse here. When they just passed that law, it's going to go into effect tomorrow too, where the back to blue to give the police more rights to hurt us.
Okay, Chris, we've got a break. Your point is well taken. Thank you for calling in from Des Moines. Chris, one of our listeners, before we go to break, just to mention here, polling on this from the Iowa poll, I had Ann Seltzer on. Seltzer, a great public opinion researcher, of course, from Des Moines, asked if Iowans, if they were favor or oppose this change in the law. 56% of Iowans say they oppose it, according to the poll. Just over one-third say they are in favor. 10% aren't sure. Very quickly, Karen, before we go to break and pull Dennis back on board when we come back, does this surprise you, this poll results?
I'm actually gratified by it. And I think it demonstrates that this is really a solution in search of a problem.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University. Dennis Goldford, perhaps his lights are back on and his power is back on, can rejoin us. We sure hope so. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we do, we'll talk about related news here. Yesterday, the U.S. House voting to remove statues honoring Confederate and other white supremacist leaders from public display at the U.S. Capitol. We'll talk about that and tell you how our House delegation from Iowa voted on removing those statues. When we return, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay with us.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University. And back with us after a power failure, evidently in his house, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Dennis, are you back with us?
Speaking of infrastructure.
All right. Well, I was going to say, I thought we talked about not having you plug your waffle iron in during the show, but that wasn't the cause.
I have no idea what happened. I assume it was the neighborhood or something, but
glad to have you back with us.
Infrastructure.
All right. We're talking in the last half hour, a little bit into this half hour. We want to get into some other issues, but the change in state law taking place in effect tomorrow, banning the teaching of certain concepts, including that the U.S. or state of Iowa is fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist. Dennis, I want to give you a chance to respond here. But first of all, General Mark Milley, this is a bit of audio that has been in a lot of the news. He this month, the top general responding to Republican lawmakers' criticism that the Pentagon's efforts to combat racism and promote diversity made them too, quote, woke. Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley said he found these accusations offensive.
On the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out. I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that, because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it. I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx. I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend?
Okay. Dennis, share your reaction to the words of Joint Chiefs Chair General Mark Milley fielding accusations by Republican lawmakers that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing.
I don't know how anybody could improve on what General Milley had to say. As an academic, anytime I hear talk about banning the teaching of X, Y, or Z, that makes me tremendously nervous. And I often tell students, when we deal with difficult concepts or theories in class, you can agree with X, Y, or Z, you can disagree with X, Y, or Z, but what you cannot do is ignore it. And I think that critical race theory was a relatively obscure academic theory, and I think that a lot of people who use the term, particularly among Republicans and conservatives now, but I think the general public, don't have a clear idea as to what that really means or involves. So, again, I miss, because of the power issue, so much of the discussion. We don't have time to go into the details of that. But I think the important thing, as the general said, is whether you are comfortable or uncomfortable with a particular point of view, if you have to deal with it in life, the important thing is to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Let's move through some other issues that we promised at the outset. Related, yesterday, the U.S. House voted to remove statues honoring Confederate and other white supremacist leaders from public display at the U.S. Capitol. This was a vote of 285 to 120 to approve the legislation. This is banishing the likenesses of Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, Jefferson Davis, a dozen other figures associated with the Confederacy or white supremacist causes. 67 Republicans joining with every Democrat in the U.S. House to support these changes, but still a majority of the Republican Party in the House standing against this removal of these statues. What do you make of this vote, Karen?
Well, I think it's an important vote. And this has been, you know, of course, happening around the country with the removal of statues toward and other memorials that valorize the Confederacy. And I think that there's an important point. You know, I lived in the American South for quite a while, and I heard the arguments that, you know, this is our heritage and we're going to forget our history. We can't just erase our history. I don't think anybody is erasing the Civil War. What is different is that what we are doing is removing monuments to people who committed treason in defense of a political and economic system that was based on a gross violation of human rights. And I don't think that should be valorized. I think it needs to be taught. I think it needs to be understood, but it doesn't need to be celebrated.
In our congressional delegation, Dennis, before you jump in here, just to give the votes of our congressional delegation on this U.S. House vote yesterday to remove statues honoring Confederate and other white supremacist leaders from public display at the U.S. Capitol, District 1 Representative Hinson voted yes. In District 2, Miller Meeks voted nay. Axne, District 3, yay. And District 4, Feenstra, nay. So split there among our delegation in the U.S. House. Dennis, your comment.
Well, remember, the Republican base 100 years ago was essentially the Northeast, the Great Lakes, and the West Coast. And the Democratic base was the South and the interior West. And what's happened over the last 60 years is a complete flip of those bases. Now the Republican base is the South and the interior West. The Republicans have, if you add up all the seats held by the in the House of Representatives by members from the 11 states of the Confederacy, 73% of those seats currently are in Republican hands. They're held by Republicans. So Republicans certainly don't want to antagonize their base in this regard. It's not itself a Trump kind of base, although it's related. And there's still the persistence of the so-called lost cause myth, which is that the, as Karen certainly knows from having lived in the South, they don't call it the Civil War there. That's the war between the states or the war of Northern aggression. And the argument after the Civil War was that that was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. Well, go back and read the ordinances of secession put out by the states of the Confederacy to justify secession. They talked about slavery and the Northern attack on that institution. But this is obviously in the wake of George Floyd and everything else nowadays, an attempt to deal with our history. And that always causes great conflict.
Mm-hmm. An interesting vote also in light of the recent House and Senate vote overwhelmingly this month earlier to make Juneteenth a federal holiday for commemorating the end of slavery. And then going back a little bit further, it was January that Congress overrode a veto by former President Trump to enact legislation that would, among other things, direct the military to strip the name of Confederate leaders from bases in the coming years. Karen, your final words on this before we move on.
Well, I would say that the progress of history is full of fits and starts. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here.
Okay. A comment from one of our listeners, Kelly, says, taking it down, I assume he or she means the statues, doesn't negate the good things about the person it hurts. Okay, one of the comments there. Tom from Des Moines, comment from him, one of our listeners, a key part of this is an unwillingness to acknowledge that systemic racism is a problem. Let's move on before the hour cuts us off here to another issue, the House passing a bill to speed visas for Afghans imperiled who aided U.S. troops in Afghanistan. We're going to hear a bit of a previous interview that I did here, but yesterday the House voted overwhelmingly to speed up the process that would allow these Afghans to migrate to the U.S. We know the American military is in the final phases of withdrawing from Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of war. More than 18,000 Afghans, they've worked for the U.S. as interpreters, drivers, engineers, security guards, embassy clerks. Now they're stuck in this bureaucratic morass of applying for special immigrant visas, visas available to people who face threats because of the work they did for the U.S. government. And this month I spoke with one former Afghan interpreter about the court deciding not to grant him asylum in the years it took his case to play out. Zalmay Niazi became part of the neighborhood in the community of Iowa Falls. Before that, he helped U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. And according to Niazi, he risks death if he returns to Afghanistan. Here he is on this show talking with me about his hopes for staying in the country.
I'm ready to fight. This is I always fought against the terrorists and their organizations, and I want to fight this. And as a human, all I want to be alive. I serve this country, and I have done what was right. And not only the benefit of the serve I did was for Afghanistan, but it was for the United States too. They achieved their mission successfully, and interpreters were they played a key role in Operation Enduring Freedom, as Mr. Song said. And I am crossing fingers, and I am very hopeful that it goes the right direction, and I get to stay because Almighty God saved my life many times due to threats and persecution and accidents I had. And hopefully they will be granting my asylum and I get to stay in the country and achieve my goal and can live like 300 million people that live in this great country.
That from a few days ago on this program, Zalmay Niazi, a resident of Iowa Falls, and that his case is in the courts now. An overwhelming House vote to speed up the process that would allow such Afghans who are imperiled for aiding the U.S. to immigrate to the U.S. Karen, your thoughts on this move and in the larger context of, well, this rapid exit from Afghanistan?
Well, and those of us who are old enough to remember the U.S. Withdrawal from Vietnam, that's an important case study in everything that went wrong and our failure to protect the people who worked with us and showed that they were true patriots in terms of, you know, fighting with the Americans and supporting the American cause. So I think we have a moral imperative to help these people get out of Afghanistan and to be able to settle in the United States, and that we cannot repeat the mistakes that we made after Vietnam.
Right. And evidently our congressional delegation agrees with that assessment. Dennis, your thoughts?
Well, there's that moral aspect, certainly, as Karen stated so well. There's the practical aspect as well. If the U.S. gets involved in another culture or another country in a conflict, and but Americans are known for leaving behind or throwing to the wolves anybody who helps the Americans, we'll never get that help in those conflicts either. So there's a practical side to that as well.
Yeah, there is. And of course, Karen, you taking us back to the 1970s, those of us who were around there also remember, what we would, most of us would agree would be the shining light, the actions of former Iowa Governor Republican Robert Ray in being a state that really stepped to the fore in welcoming refugees in dire need from Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War, Karen. That's also what you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And that, you know, part of protecting the people who worked and served with the U.S. military forces is, of course, welcoming them into our communities. And I wasn't in Iowa at the time, but I was in Minneapolis, and I remember how the churches really stepped forward to sponsor Vietnamese families and then helped with the immigration of family members who came over for years and years afterwards. And of course, their presence just enriches the community.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a couple minutes talking about this, another law going into effect tomorrow. Two-thirds of Iowans say they oppose this new law, allowing adults to purchase and carry handguns without a permit. This reported by the Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll today. This is the law that our governor signed this spring, set to take effect tomorrow. It will make it optional for adults 21 and older to get permits before they buy or carry handguns. The results of the poll here, less than a third of Iowans, 30%, favor the measure. Two-thirds, 67% oppose it. I'm sorry, I don't have the breakdown in terms of party affiliation there. But Dennis, your thoughts on this law going into effect tomorrow and the public's attitudes evidently not in tune with this newly enacted law?
Well, you can imagine what the party breakdown would be. Democrats would be very opposed to a law that allowed right to carry without a permit, and Republicans would be very supportive of that, and independents probably lean in the Republican direction in that regard, I'm guessing, at this point. But, you know, as we know, the gun issue is a highly charged issue. Over the course of my studies in life, I lived in Europe for a total of 3 years and a summer, and they just would always get wide-eyed when they hear something about guns in America. They just couldn't believe the way we allow and deal with these sorts of things. They don't support a lot of the rights we have, or they don't understand them, at least. But what's occurred, I think, particularly with this sense on the part of Republicans that right now, at least, because Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they don't see the federal government as a friendly place. And Republicans have a lot more control of state legislatures and governorships, and they're using those while they have that control to pass all sorts of legislation, not just on economic matters, if you will, but these cultural matters and these key issues of concern to people on the more conservative side of the ledger. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're seeing, this general approach on the part of Republicans to make hay while they can because they control these state legislatures and governorships.
Mm-hmm. On the way out, let's talk a little bit about this continuing theme following the January 6th insurrection, the attacks on the U.S. Capitol, the riot. Several weeks ago, the Senate voting to block legislation to form a bipartisan independent commission investigating the attack by Trump's supporters. Iowa's congressional delegation remaining split on that commission. Representative Miller Meeks, among the 34 House Republicans who voted to create that commission, because in her words, we need to make sure something like this never happens again. Senators Ernst and Grassley, among the 35 nays in the Senate, that cloture motion rejected. Now we have earlier this month, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing that House Democrats will form a select committee to investigate the January 6th attack. We have to remember a violent mob overran police, broke into the building, hunted for lawmakers to try to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. This was not a tourist visit that got a little wild by any means, as it has been portrayed by some. Let's get your prognosis for the future of this select committee and of really answering some of the core questions that have yet to be answered surrounding this. Karen, would you go first on this? Will we reach a consensus as to the causes of the January 6th Capitol riots, as we did for 9/11?
Well, I think that there will be a majoritarian view, and then there will be a minority view. What I'm concerned about is, you know, the committee is going to be bipartisan, as well it should be, but that that there might be appointees on the Republican side who are not going to give this an honest effort, but are going to use this as an opportunity to grandstand and to repeat the lies about the validity of the 2020 election, and to sort of promote those Trumpian lines, and then that could just simply turn the entire thing into a circus. Mm-hmm. So I think maintaining some decorum and being able to stay focused on the question at hand, that if those things are accomplished, the committee can really discover some important things that I think will be very important for Homeland Security and for law enforcement to know about domestic terrorism.
Right, and including the key questions, how our government and law enforcement missed intelligence leading up to the rioting, and also, of course, the role of former President Trump before and during the insurrection.
Yes, or potentially members of the House as well. I mean,
right.
there's some belief that that there might have been people from Congress who had some involvement.
Dennis, your thoughts?
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I would say, of course, the Democrats would have preferred, and some Republicans would have preferred, an independent commission to do this. Republicans didn't allow it. And therefore, Pelosi is doing what she's allowed to do, which is establish this select committee, although it certainly will be bipartisan, but you will have grandstanders. But the main question you have to ask is, for those who oppose investigating this awful event, what are you afraid we'll find out? What are you afraid we'll find out? And one of the key functions of Congress involved in representation and lawmaking is fact-finding. You've got to know what happened. And that's what this is focused on. The question is whether, in fact, it's a minority aim to make this a real circus in order to delegitimize it.
Right. But, I mean, we're hearing from Republicans that for very practical reasons, they feared that independent commission would drag into 2022, become a distraction, they say, for Democrats' failure to do much under Biden. Dennis.
Well, that, of course, is to politicize the investigation. No, we can't have this investigation because Democrats want to use it simply to mask what Republicans argue are the failures of the Biden administration. So it's already politicized. You can't win for losing there. And I think what the Democrats are trying to do, certainly they've got a political interest in doing this, but I think there is an interest, and you saw this from people like Representative Cheney and others, that we've got to find out what happened. And as I said, the question is, what are you afraid you will find out that makes you so opposed to looking into it?
And with that question, we leave this hour with Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center at Iowa State University and political science professor. Karen, Dennis, thank you so much. Dennis, sorry about your power failure. Glad that everything seems to be all right now.
Well, it seems to be. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you. Bye,
Karen. All right, thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye now.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
River to River, produced by Zachary Oren Smith, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We'll look at highlights from the past U.S. Supreme Court term, nearly past, tomorrow on the program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope you'll join us then.